Thank you to the organisers for the opportunity to present and Fari for that introduction. Banks have a central role in facilitating activity in modern economies. Their role is just as important today as it was prior to the financial crisis. But the nature of banking has changed, and given developments in technology, data, competition, banking will need to continue to evolve. Today, I'm going to discuss these changes in banking. To put these changes in context first, I want to provide a bit of a framework. I want to consider the special role that banks play in our economy. I would then like to focus on how banks have changed since the financial crisis in Australia, and outline some of the issues that banks are facing today that could see banking change even more in the coming years. First of all, I should notice today that when I refer to banks, I'm talking about all authorised deposit-taking institutions, but banks is just much easier to say, so I'll use that term. While the Australian banking system performed very well through the financial crisis, with the system remaining well-capitalised and profitable, the financial crisis did have an impact on Australia, and there's a lot that we can learn from the rest of the world. So first of all, there are four characteristics that define what is the special role that banks play in economies. First of all, banks accept deposits, and in doing so, they provide the households and businesses with a risk-free and liquid asset. Secondly, they engage in maturity and liquidity transformation. They take deposits and short-term debt, which are liquid, and convert these into long-term loans, which are illiquid. Thirdly, they play a central role in the payment system. And lastly, they also have expertise in credit and risk management, which they've developed through a very long history and through having a very close relationship with their customers. The first three of these characteristics all relate to key benefits that banks receive from public authorities. In particular, banks have the authority to accept deposits, they have an account at the central bank, and they have direct access to emergency liquidity from the central bank. These three benefits define the special role of banks in the economy. Bank deposits become a risk-free asset for households and businesses because they have an effective government guarantee up to a limit, and because they have first claim on the assets of the financial institution. Bank deposits are liquid because, as well as the cash that the bank holds in order to meet physical withdrawals, they also have an account at the central bank, which means that they can settle payments of their customers to customers of other banks. It is because banks have accounts at the central bank that they're central to the payment system. Even in tumultuous times, deposits are liquid because banks can convert the potentially illiquid assets into highly liquid deposits at the central bank. In the worst case, the financial claim scheme in Australia pays out deposits in a timely manner. So these properties mean that depositors are confident that they can withdraw their deposits at any time and their deposits remain safe. And these benefits help to mitigate one of the key risks of banking. That is that maturity and liquidity transformation create the risk of a bank run. With access to stable deposits and central bank liquidity, banks are able to safely do more liquidity and maturity transformation than otherwise. These key benefits go hand in hand with banks' critical role in taking deposits and intermediating and financing economic activity. Because of their role, banks are subject to prudential regulation. Prudential regulation has benefits and costs to economies. In economies, we try to equate the marginal cost and marginal benefits. From society's perspective, the key benefit to prudential regulation is that it reduces the risk the depositors and the economies face from bank failures. On the other hand, the costs of more regulation are that it reduces the amount of intermediation in the economy, making that intermediation more expensive. To calibrate the optimal degree of regulation, public authorities try to balance these costs and benefits. But we can also think about the costs and benefits of prudential regulation from the perspective of banks. For banks, regulation can increase their costs, but it also has significant benefits for banks as well. It provides banks with deposits, which are a relatively cheap form of funding. And in the worst state of the world, the benefits from this prudential regulation can be even greater because those deposits are sticky, and in the worst case, they have access to central bank liquidity. So those benefits are particularly valuable to banks. Globally, the financial crisis delivered a shock that was more severe to banking systems and the economy than we had thought was likely to be the case. Before the crisis, it was widely thought that banks had improved their risk management, and further, that economic and financial volatility had declined. As a result, it was judged that a severe financial crisis or shock was highly unlikely. But the financial crisis came along, which internationally resulted in bank failures in many economies and severe recessions in many. This led to a re-evaluation of how likely and how extreme banking crises could be. Globally, authorities recognised that the benefits of tighter prudential regulation would outweigh the costs. From the bank's perspective, it also became apparent that the benefits of tighter prudential regulation were more valuable than they had previously appreciated. This was because banks' increased recognition of how likely and how severe shocks to the financial system could be, and so the size of the potential benefit for their balance sheets. In fact, in some countries, the benefits of being a bank were so great that we saw non-banks convert to being a bank. The international reassessment of banking regulation led to the Basel III reforms. The reforms focused on improving banks' resilience, limiting banks' maturity transformation, and ensuring that they improved their credit assessment and management of risks. Despite the extreme shock globally, the Australian banking system performed remarkably well through the crisis. In Australia, there was significant fiscal and monetary stimulus, and the various measures were enacted to support the banking system directly. And additionally, there was a bit of luck. But the good performance of the Australian banking system, to a large extent, reflected the strength of prudential regulation prior to the crisis, as well as banks' own management of risks. Despite this, the lessons learned internationally, it was apparent that there were still benefits from it to be made in Australian banking. The Basel III reforms in Australia have been adopted on or ahead of schedule, tightening a prudential regulation that already exceeded global minimum standards. The reforms have encouraged banks to put greater emphasis on incorporating the costs of capital and liquidity into all aspects of their operations. Tier 1 capital ratios in Australia have increased by 50% since 2006, and most of this has been of the highest quality forms of capital. At current levels, Australian banks are estimated to have sufficient capital to withstand the types of shocks that have led to banking crises historically in many economies. This has resulted in a reduction in risk-taking by banks. Banks sold some of their higher risk assets that were not performing particularly well and earning sufficient rates of return. Australian banks have pulled back from international banking, particularly in the UK and Asia, where the returns had been disappointing and had not and had often not met their own cost of capital. Banks have also increased their mortgage lending, which requires much less capital because of the collateral protecting these loans. Most banks have also sought to divest their life insurance and wealth management operations. These divestments were precipitated by changes in capital rules that increased the amount of capital that had to be held for intra-group investments. They also reflected that these investments had failed to deliver the benefits expected, including cross-selling and an appreciation of the non-financial risks involved in the investments. The introduction of the liquidity regulations, the liquidity coverage ratio and the net stable funding ratio, contribute to a substantial rise in banks' liquid asset holdings, as shown in this chart here, which went from 15% of banks' assets to 20% of banks' assets. And most of this increase, again, was in the highest quality form of liquid assets, high quality liquid assets, in particular government securities. The liquidity regulations contributed to a reduction in liquidity and maturity transformation. This has substantially changed the composition of banks' liabilities. We can see here. Banks have significantly reduced their use of short-term debt while increasing their use of domestic deposits. By applying transfer pricing across their whole business, banks now aim to ensure that all business decisions take into account the degree of maturity and liquidity transformation. The regulatory changes have made, and banks' better recognition of financial risks have restricted growth in Australian banks' profits in past few years. The divestment of their wealth investment management operations have reduced their profits. But even focusing on return on assets, profitability has declined by more than one-fifth since the crisis. Two important contributors have been the increased holding of high-quality liquid assets and a more general decline in risk-taking and so reward. The fall in profitability has been even larger, about one-third, when measured as by return on equity, because of the increase in equity outstanding. But the decline in profitability does not relate to reduced cost of financial intermediation for customers. The spread between lending rates and funding costs, or the cash rate, has actually increased a little. This combination of higher costs to customers and lower profits to banks reflects the anticipated cost of tighter prudential regulation. Banks' absolute cost of equity has also declined. The decline in absolute COE has been less pronounced than the fall in the risk-free rate as proxied by government bond yields. So the risk premium on banks' equity has actually risen a little. We can see here. This is consistent with equity investors having revised up their assessment of the riskiness of investing in banks, even as banks have been forced to deleverage and to hold more liquid assets. Since the return on equity has fallen by more than the cost of equity, banks have become less valuable. One way to think about this is that since banks are now obliged to be less leveraged, they generate a lower expected return on equity in excess of the risk-free rate. If the cost of financing a bank were independent of the mix of debt and equity, that is, we lived in a Modigliani-Miller world, then issuing more debt would reduce the cost to the bank of debt and equity, so keeping the total cost of financing unchanged. There are many reasons why the Modigliani-Miller theorem may not hold, including in this situation, the government guarantee on banks' deposits. This means that bank deposits don't become cheaper for banks as they issue more equity, and so the cost of overall debt doesn't decline. But with the bank issuing more relatively expensive equity, the total cost of funding rises, which explains why banks become less profitable when they are obliged to reduce their equity their debt equity ratios. Despite the decline in equity, return on equity, Australian banks continue to generate a return on equity that's well in excess of their cost of equity. They trade at price to book ratios in excess of one and higher than banks in many other parts of the world, showing that investors still see significant benefits in investing in Australian banks. While the past decade has seen substantial changes in banking in Australia, I also want to mention some issues that could see banks change even more over the coming years. The first is the general access to and availability to process data. This is facilitating the emergence of new technology-driven competitors to banks. These competitors could potentially impact banks' dominant position in the financial system. A second issue is the impact of tighter prudential regulation on banks. And a third is changes in expectations for banks' obligations to the community. A substantial influence on banking at the moment is the rapid change in technology. We are currently seeing a massive increase in the availability of data and the ability to process that data. This could erode, or potentially even eradicate, banks' historical advantage in credit risk assessment. There are two parts to this. Regulatory changes mean that banks' private customer data can be made available to others. And second, that non-banks have some data which is valuable for banking business. The first part to this is the consumer data right and open banking. The consumer data right makes it clear that customers own their own data, and open banking provides customers with the ability to share their account information with other entities, including non-banks. Using these data, a non-bank could suggest cards or accounts that better suit a customer's purposes. They can also be used for detailed credit risk assessment. On top of this, comprehensive credit reporting is providing more information to banks and to non-bank lenders about the potential history of potential borrowers. The second part is some non-banks have data that are becoming more valuable for banking services. Much of this data is collected by big tech firms such as Google and Apple. For example, PayPal and Amazon have substantial data on the sales of their merchant customers, while social networking connections have been found to be useful in predicting borrowers' commitment to make repayments on their loans. Technology firms, for whom collecting and analysing data is in their DNA, are a new type of competitor for banks who historically have struggled to make the most of the private data they hold. How well individual banks respond to technology challenges will influence, no doubt, their relative success in the coming years. Technology changes in payments are also challenging banks' central role in facilitating payments. So far, this erosion has been most apparent in emerging market economies where payment systems had not necessarily always met customers' needs. For example, in China and several African countries, online marketplaces and mobile phone companies have come to dominate payments, largely bypassing the banking system. But in Australia and other developed economies, existing electronic payment systems, including new real-time payment systems, such as Australia's NPP, are already meeting customers' needs. Still, new payment providers can always partner with banks and credit card companies to reduce the banking system's profits from the payment system. Where banks have provided poor service, such as in cross-border transfers, new competitors may capture market share. This is already occurring with specialist firms undercutting banks' wide spreads in cross-border payments. Cross-border payments are a potential entry point also for stable coins, which could be used to make low-cost payments across borders, completely bypassing the banking system. A second issue for banks is the impact that tighter prudential regulation has on their cost of intermediating borrowing and saving. Tighter prudential regulation, such as holding more capital and more liquid assets, was anticipated by regulators to increase the cost of intermediation. These expected higher costs have been taken into account in calibrating regulation and have been judged to be appropriate to reduce the cost of financial crises. But higher costs for banks can push more borrowing to non-banks and directly into capital markets. The share of credit intermediated by non-banks in Australia is relatively small, and so the risks to financial stability are limited. But if this were to grow substantially, it was something we would have to watch quite carefully. A third issue for banks comes from expectations in terms of their obligations to the community. Banks will need to adapt to a range of reforms designed to strengthen governance and a culture at financial institutions. This should lead to less non-financial risk and better management of those risks. These measures include the Banking Executive Accountability Regime, APRA's proposed standards for the structure of variable remuneration, and other changes in response to the shortcomings that were identified by the Royal Commission. While these measures will require banks to adapt and will have cost in the near term, no doubt, they will make banks more resilient, increasing their chances of responding to new competitors. To sum up, while banks are facing various challenges, their special role in the economy provides them with several advantages. Deposits are overall a lower cost and very stable form of funding. And providing depositors with liquid assets puts banks at the centre of the payment system and gives them a strong connection with customers. Banks have adapted following the financial crisis, and they will need to continue to evolve in the coming years to face the new challenges they have. Greater availability of data reduces one of banks' key advantages, and changes in technology introduce a new type of competitor. For now, the banking system remains core to modern economies. Australian banks in particular serve critical functions in the Australian economy by providing credit intermediation and more generally facilitating economic activity. Australian banks are profitable and resilient, and a strong banking system has contributed to the many years of economic growth in Australia. The eight largest banks in Australia can trace their history back on average 140 years. But what role today's individual banks play in the banking system in the future will depend on how they adapt to the changes that they're facing. So thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Any comments or questions about Australian banking system as well as global banking system?
Hello, this is Boso from the Australian Financial Review. If I could ask you just two questions, one more directly related to your remit on financial stability, and the second more on the theme of the conference about climate change, if that's okay. So the first is, Deloitte forecasts that super funds are going to own roughly two-thirds of the share market in about 20 years. They're obviously huge holders of infrastructure and also are lending to private companies. So I'm wondering what risks to stability does that high concentration of ownership pose, and whether you've thought about that in your oversight of financial stability. And the second is, one on climate change, one big trend we saw this year was countries like Sweden's central bank dumping Queensland and Western Australian state government bonds over climate change concerns. I wondered whether that was a trend that you saw continuing into next year and what kind of risks that poses to the economy.
Okay, thank you. First of all, the increase in superannuation funds is something that's been happening for many years. It's a long-moving trend. The important thing to note about superannuation funds is that they're not actually, by and large, individually leveraged. And it's leverage that we typically find is the greatest contributor to risk in the financial system. But super funds do still have a role to play in financial stability. They individually have a very large share of deposits at banks. They own about a quarter of banks' equity and also fund about a quarter of banks' short-term debt. So they're certainly important, and what we need to understand is how their role changes and how they respond to financial shocks. So we can look at the financial crisis, and we've done that to an extent, and the superannuation funds seem to actually play somewhat of a stabilising role. The important thing is that the superannuation system is actually effectively a closed system, and so the funds can move from one super fund to another, but by and large they can't leave the superannuation system. And so that provides a degree of stability. That will change to an extent as the superannuation system moves from being more of a paying in stage to a paying out stage with the aging in the population. And so that's something that we'll need to monitor. But, you know, this comes to superannuation funds have their appropriate liquidity standards and things that they need to manage. On climate change, this is a growing issue for financial stability. It's something that central banks and other regulators around the world are paying significant attention to. In the most recent financial stability review, which we published in October, that's a great read if you haven't looked at it, we had a box on climate change. This is it's a slow-moving risk that we're facing. You pointed to one particular risk, which was, you know, of some institutions, some investors changing their investment mandates and so wanting to reduce their exposure to carbon-intensive investments. So that's something that no doubt can happen, and the market will respond to that. But the price signals that come out of market responses are something that economies are used to dealing with, and that can encourage and facilitate change. So it can be a good thing. Any more questions? Right up the back. Sorry.
Where the banks should be taking a more proactive role when it comes to climate change, the central banks and banks in general.
Sure. Okay, so for those who didn't hear all of it, the question was either about banks and central banks should be taking a more proactive role in responding to climate change. So central banks obviously have their mandate, and that's what they're responsible for. In Australia, the Reserve Bank's mandate is for price stability, responding to trying to ensure full employment and the welfare of the Australian people. So to the extent that climate change is impacting these things, and including in financial stability, which comes into our mandate, that's certainly something that we take into account. I think banks also have been looking at climate change quite significantly. They face potential physical risks and transition risks, the risks that Professor Engel outlined. They also faced potential reputational risks. And I think that's one of the things that in the very short term drives banks' responses. They know that their customers are watching them. They know that investors are watching them. And so they're mindful about their actions. And I think, you know, again, this is one of the forces that can drive change, and banks adapting. Another question just in the middle here. We've just got a microphone coming.
Thanks, Dr. Keynes, for a wonderful presentation. I had just one question. Can you comment... I'm Tohin. I'm from University of Texas. Can you comment a bit about application of blockchain in banks, both as a complement as well as challenge? Maybe the new players coming in and how they pose a challenge, as well as how the technology itself can be a complement to the banking industry.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think of where my financial stability link to that is. So obviously, financial system is always adapting and looking at new technology. The technology changes that, as I discussed today, are facilitating a lot of potential new entrants into the financial system. And that is providing a degree of change. I think banks, like all other potential participants in the financial system, are looking for any potential uses of new technologies, such as blockchain. And there are some uses that are being used, in particular, looking at settlement. Any new technology potentially entails risks for the financial system, so we need to monitor and understand it. And so far, I think, you know, what we've seen has been, you know, done in a reasonable way, and the risks to the financial system haven't been that great.
Just, I have a question, and that is with regard to trust. The UNSW as a university is promoting the concept of trust. And I noted there are a number of organizations like OECD is also coming and saying, well, if we talk about communities' expectation of banks, we need to increase trust of community in our banking system and the way it's governed. And one of the elements of this trust is the quality of governance of banking system in general, but particularly commercial banks specifically. I just wonder whether there is any interaction, if you like, between policymakers, regulators, with respect to enhancing the trust when we look at the actual governance of commercial banks. Thanks.
Thanks. That's a very important and topical question. So in Australia, APRA, who's our prudential regulator, has the greatest interaction with the banks and other financial institutions with regard to their governance. And clearly that is important, in that trust in the financial system is imperative. Now, the first point, we need trust in that banks, that customers believe that their deposits are safe. And so that's delivered quite simply through the financial claims scheme, depositors' first claim on deposits. But more broadly, we need a community that has strong trust in the financial system, in that it's able to deliver the purpose that the community sees the financial system there is there for. We need banks that are intermediating financial activity, and that customers are comfortable with the way that that's being done, that banks are making the right decisions in that. So it's absolutely critical that banks do develop that trust, that the community has strong trust, and APRA is at the front line of doing that, but the Reserve Bank is certainly watching that and taking close attention. We've got a microphone.
You mentioned that the banks have reduced their risk-taking and that they are well-capitalized. Do you feel like that expanding the risk-taking would be something that would be good for the Australian economy? And do they blame their regulator for not letting them do this? This is something that you observe. I observe when you look at banking systems that survived the financial crisis very well, they tend to have banking systems that aren't sufficiently aggressive in providing capital to small medium enterprises that are. And I wonder if you see that here.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. You've been in the country a couple of days and already picked up on one of the most pertinent issues that we're facing. So very insightful. I mean, Australian banks are certainly still providing credit and keen to lend. So we have seen there's been an increase in mortgage lending in recent months in response to the cuts in the cash rate and the increase in demand that stimulated. But we have seen that there is relatively anemic growth, particularly to small businesses, a little bit easier access to credit for larger businesses. And something that's certainly something that is a concern, because small businesses can be a very dynamic part of the economy who generate significant new employment and potential productivity growth. So there have been some efforts to ensure that banks understand their obligations with regard to and where those obligations don't apply. So in Australia, we have responsible lending obligations which apply to banks lending to households for personal purposes, but not to businesses. And so our regulator, ASIC, has been very clear in stating that responsible lending obligations do not apply for business loans. So in that regard, business loans can involve a greater degree of risk, and they're always going to involve risk. You know, if there was no risk in making business loans, there'd be no payoff either to, you know, the entrepreneur or to the bank. So it is absolutely critical that banks continue to be willing to manage risk and take on risk, and that's where they're adding something to the productive capacity of the economy. So it is something that we're mindful of. The regulations have not in any regard formally constrained banks' ability to take on those risks. Rather, it comes to the bank's own internal processes and management of that. And I think it's been important that banks set up their internal procedures such that their staff know where their bounds lie, know how they're able to take on risk, and are comfortable taking on risk, because ultimately that's what banks do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.